We all know that women are not funny. And no one proves it better than Kay Ballard, the accidental lawyer who is the accidental host of our show. Of course, every accident that Kay Ballard encounters is intentional. And now her intention is to accidentally disprove the show's premise. So sit back and enjoy a fun conversation that matters between Kay and today's fabulous featured guest. Welcome to Women Are Not Funny Radio.
Hello, this is Kay Ballard, and I'm so glad to be here today. And I know you're glad as well, because today our featured guest is feminist author and activist Gloria Felt. On the occasion of the release of her new book, No Excuses, 9 Ways Women Can Change Now and Change How We Think About Power. Now, first, a warning. Gloria and I both grew up in Texas, and we are both intelligent, well-educated, and generally well-spoken. But today, we're going to say y'all. We're going to use the idiom y'all. Gloria tweeted y'all, and I saw it, and I said, why not? So today, we'll resort to that treasured Texas expression. And when we say y'all, we mean you. All. So the thesis of Gloria's book is that women need to change the way we think about power and then claim that power so that we can lead. Our conversation could go in a number of directions because the truth is I have enough notes and questions and ideas for a 10-hour conversation with Gloria. And that's not an exaggeration. So I'm not going to pause any longer, blathering on in solitude. I'm going to bring her on. But as you know, even though I am not paranoid, I must ask the fundamental questions to let me know where things stand. And the first question may seem funny in the light of the fact that Gloria is powerful, already successful, and well-connected. But, Gloria, I must know, are you using this appearance on Women Are Not Funny Radio as a stepping stone to something better?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's always something better ahead, you know? And I'm going to use this to be very brazen and blatant about the stepping stone that I'm on right now, that I want to leap from to someplace even bigger and better. And that is that I am so passionate about the message that I have for women and No Excuses that I want it out in every possible medium. You know, one of my power tools is employ every medium. And, I mean, I want to be on Oprah. I want to be on Jon Stewart. I want to be on Bill Maher. I want to be on the Today Show. So I'm going to use this as a stepping stone to tell all your listeners, help me, because I can't seem to get their attention just yet, but I will if I have your help.
My goodness, that's so funny. In your answer, you listed a number of people who are hoping to be on Women Are Not Funny.
So, well, Gloria, I hope they are.
Sorry, I have to ask, though. I mean, truly. You obviously do know a lot about media and old media and have probably had even a lot of media training. Is it your goal to take over my show?
Well, you know, I hadn't really thought about it, but gosh, since you brought it up.
Gloria,
please,
darling.
Should, you know, think about that. No, I'm serious. Seriously, I've actually been thinking about doing a radio show of my own, and so I'd like to learn from what you do. But I think you have your own special spin here, so you should do it. That's it. This is your voice. Use it.
Oh, Gloria, I'm glad you accept that. I really am. Because, see, the fact of the matter is you have my dream career. You have become, darling, a public intellectual. And that...
Well, I'm public anyway.
That is very, very cool. Well, I confess to you in our brief pre-production meeting just before the show started that I was concerned that the show would be just an infomercial telling people to buy your book, because I am telling them that now. I love your book. I think everyone should buy it. But there is someone I know who is well-known for interviewing well-known authors, and he always in his interviews says, buy 3 copies of the book. Buy one for yourself, buy one for a friend, and then buy one for someone that, you know, you'll happen upon. Well,
that's great advice.
Well, listen though, Gloria. You just don't know me well enough to know I am not someone to be outdone. So what I want to tell listeners, and by listeners, I mean y'all, is to buy two books for yourself, because you need one, and goodness knows, just trust me on this, you might end up dropping one in the pedicure basin, and so buy two for yourself, buy five for known friends, because surely you have five friends, you know, just one friend, buy one book for a friend, that doesn't make sense, and then buy five for those new friends that you're going to happen upon. So instead of buying three books, I say buy a dozen. Are you okay with that, Gloria?
I, you know, just you could even add some zeros on the end of that, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I will not go that far. I will not go that far. I'm just saying by 12. By 12, that's I think that's sufficient.
Cheaper by the dozen, better by the dozen. That's a good. I'm gonna have to play with that slogan and put that in my next newsletter.
Well, the fact of the matter is, I was so concerned about sounding like an infomercial. I put together three things about your book that I didn't like much. Okay.
Great.
I mean, I still love the book. I still love the book. I still say buy a dozen. But there are three things that I have, you know, a little bit of a problem with. Okay.
Great.
Well, the first one, and I'm dead serious about this. This is wrong, Gloria. This is just wrong. You tell these amazing stories about women that you've encountered, because prior to writing your book, you spent we've always been in touch with women about these issues, but you dedicated a year to having conversations with a number of people about the subject matter. And when you relate those conversations, you always do it in a very interesting way. But the other thing that you always do, Gloria, is you always tell the woman's age. You know, what is that about? Because for me, the very best thing about being a woman is not only can you lie about your age, you're obligated to.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe they're lying to me about their ages. It could be. I'm just reporting what they've reported to me.
Well, I hope so. I hope so.
It never occurred to me, but I certainly didn't check it out. So it's quite conceivable that there could be a few people who've lied about their age.
But
I'm going to have to go check that.
Did you notice there was never a conversation without the age being mentioned, you know?
You know, I guess I'm so accustomed now to writing things that go into magazines and newspapers, and they always make you not only get the person's age, but even the birth date. So in case they've gotten a year older between the time you wrote the article and the time it's published, they know it, and they can report it that way. That's really pretty bad, isn't it?
It's so wrong. You know, this past week I filled out a form, and it had a little drop-down menu, and what it said was, it said, choose your birth year. And I thought, isn't that fabulous? So that was, it didn't ask you what your birth year was. It asked you to choose a birth year. And so I thought that was really great. But anyway, I'm going to forgive you for always including the, you know, I think your explanation was good, you know, a little cheesy, but I'm going to go with it. Okay. The other thing, number two, my number two problem, you're going to be surprised about this, I think, because it's kind of fundamental to your book. You talk about, well, the whole thing is about women's ambivalence towards power and our unwillingness to claim it much of the time. And you think it may be a matter of word choice, that redefining the word power is the way to go. So you talk about thinking of power instead of power over, thinking about power to. And I don't object to this. I just question it. Talk about that a bit.
Well, sure. One of the things that I learned on the front lines of movement leadership is that whoever defines the issue generally wins the debate. And what I found when I started talking with women about the whole notion of power, let me give you just two quick examples. One was in a focus group that we did. I didn't actually conduct it. Someone who actually knew how to conduct a focus group conducted it. And what she found was that, and the purpose of the focus group was that we were looking at the possibility of starting a women's leadership online course, and that may yet happen, excuse me, but But what we found was that she was interviewing women who were already in pretty significant leadership positions within their organizations. And how many of them said things like, well, whatever you do, don't put the word power in the title of this course, because power is a bad word. And as I read the transcript of the interview, what I realized was it isn't power per se, because these women all have power. It's the notion they have in their head about the bad aspects of power, the negative aspects of power that women have been having to bear the brunt of for millennia. You know, we've been the ones discriminated against. We've been the ones who've been abused. We've been, you know, there are good reasons to say that power isn't such a good thing, and yet here these women were being powerful. But the reason that they could accept the power that they had was that it was the power to feed their families, the power to, you know, to accomplish something in their jobs, the power to perhaps in some instances to be in political office and do some good, what they thought was good things for the world. So that really helped me understand that. And then when I teach my Women, Power, and Leadership course, which I do once a year at Arizona State University, and I'm teaching young women at that time, I find the same sort of thing. They get a real troubled look on their face when we start talking about power and the definitions of power. And then when I suggest that they redefine power as the power to, I just see their faces relax, and they smile, and they're comfortable with it. So first of all, changing the definition of power helps ourselves. It helps us as women to realize that we do have some strengths, and we need to use them, and we have every right to use them. But also, I think that there's just within our society that power over is an old sort of like, you know, from Mars kind of an idea. That's I can make you do something. Power to is more of from Venus. It's more like expansive and positive. And so I think power to is more like leadership, and power over is more like oppression, and we need more power to in this world.
Well, that was a lovely, lovely explanation, and I understand it, and I agree with it, sort of. But here's my experience. I mean, I actually, as a speaker, Gloria, I say from the stage in kind of my standard keynote speech about women in philanthropy, because I believe, you know, and you talk about the inequity of wages, I do too, and I think that women's powerless giving strategies or lack of strategy are one small piece of that. So I actually say from the stage, I want to be more powerful, and I want you to be more powerful too. Not so we can supplant men, but so we can lead alongside them. And I understand about the ways of talking about it that make it more attractive. But there are times, Gloria, I just get so frustrated about the whole thing. And so I came up with kind of another thing, kind of a different approach than strictly redefining it, and that is put the word on a cake and then just serve it up and say, isn't it sweet? Make cakes that take power and say,
I love it.
Take
I love
a big
it.
Bite. It may be more direct. I just, the problem I have, Gloria, with the whole idea of redefining. And I understand that. I mean, it, to me, it's a matter of, and I know that word use is a big part of culture, but it's just changing the culture around power. And I think maybe that's what you're getting at there.
Yeah, I actually think that we probably have more, there's more in common than difference in what we're saying. I do love your metaphor of the cake. I think that's great. You may find that I'm quoting you widely on that, and I promise to do it with attribution. But I do think, you know, as someone who has led organizations, I do think that we're in an era where the whole idea of power does need to be transformed. And, we're just not in an era where the old hierarchical ideas about power and leadership even apply. So I think men also are starting to sort of manage more and lead more based on a power to model. So I think it's, I'm going to keep the cake in mind. And
you know, I honestly planned to do it on occasion. I saw it in a book, you know, the idea of I would just have a photo and a book of a cake with the words on it, but I can just imagine in conferences like we both of us have gone to so much, if waiters come out with big old, you know, if there are hundreds of women in the room, maybe bring in five huge, gigantic cakes.
Great. Or even cookies. Even cookies.
Cookies, serve it up. Make cookies, them, you know, make the words sweet. Yeah. But the thing is, you know, in terms of changing the culture, it's a message of power is okay. In fact, it's really great because it's how you're able to achieve the things that you want to achieve, need to achieve, and how you have impact.
Right.
And, you know, I think I'm going to just continue to think about the concept of trying to change the definition to power to. I guess the one small kind of remaining problem for me is there are times when power over is appropriate. You know, certainly not being oppressive isn't appropriate, but there are times that you just have to, if you're in a leadership position, step up and say, it's going to be my way. And that is not, that's not power to, you know, it's still power to, but.
I can't argue with you on that. I've been in that position enough times.
most of your working life.
Even if you're thinking about it as a parent, sometimes you have to have power over your child to keep them from burning themselves up on the stove or walking out into a busy street. So mm-hmm. sure, there are always exceptions, but honestly, for the most part, when you're trying to run an organization, if you don't have power too, you're not going to last very long. Because power over just doesn't work anymore. I mean, you aren't going to have people following you. So you have to have the power to lead people where you think we need to go or where you think you need to go.
Well, that, you know, that is very, very true. And honestly, I could take the conversation in a direction that would be very, very entertaining for me because I worked in a large national organization, and I wasn't at the very top like you were, but I was very close to the top in a large national feminist organization. And you know, there's some interesting things that go on there while you're trying to walk your talk.
Yes. Did I ever say I was perfect? No. Did I?
So my third thing, once again, it's kind of a word choice. One of your mm-hmm. power tools, if you will, is sister courage. Mm-hmm. And the sister analogy is a little difficult for me. And once again, it's related to words because I think that word has so many different meanings for different people. But what you're talking about there, as I understand it, is the need for us to help other women out.
Yes, and to ask for help when we need it. Because one of the things I'm trying to remind women of is that very often, first of all, we're busy. We're really busy in our lives. And sometimes that's why, but other times it just seems overwhelming. To try to make a change, for example, in a corporate culture, or to try to make a change in a law, or whatever it is we want to change. But we feel like we're isolated, that we have a problem, like I have a problem and I have to solve it. I have to figure out how to get my kid to the doctor in the afternoon when I'm supposed to be at work. I have I have a sick mother and I need to take some time off, but my place of employment doesn't give me that option. I have this problem. What am I going to do about it? But the truth is there are probably a bunch of other people who have that same problem. And so number one is as I say, sister courage, so that we don't feel isolated, that we reach out and ask for help when we need it. We offer help when we think somebody else needs it. And then the courage part is having the courage to actually raise the issues with whoever can make the change that we think needs to happen. And then when you put them together, sister and courage, you actually have a movement. And you can marshal your facts and you can marshal your concerns, and very often you can make change, whereas one person alone couldn't do it.
Well, it's very difficult sometimes for women to help other women, and it doesn't seem to make sense. but it's there, isn't it?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what the question is. Let me step back for a minute and say that we've all heard of the Old Boys Network, right?
Mm-hmm. We've seen it.
And so, well, let's learn from that. And if the Old Boys Network has sometimes kept us out, well, what we need to do is form a new girls network. If it's difficult, that doesn't mean it shouldn't be done. I don't think it's really difficult. I think that it's just a matter of seeing the opportunity and doing it, and form a new girls network and help each other out.
Okay. Well, let me take that as a challenge, okay, and tell you mm-hmm. what I mean when I say it's difficult.
Okay.
One of the most moving stories for me in your book, and I love the way you wrote about it, Gloria, was the situation that you encountered immediately after leaving your job as president and CEO of National Planned Parenthood.
When I was a bowl of jelly?
Well, you were a bowl of jelly that had the ability to get a book agent right away. And that agent, kind of to your surprise, suggested that you write a book with the actress Kathleen Turner, who you knew very well from her work in Planned Parenthood, and you write a book about her life. And you told about that in a way that was very moving because you were so honest about it, darling, and you just made us understand how awkward and I suppose foolish you felt for having gotten in that situation, because it wasn't exactly to your liking and it didn't really serve your needs in a way that it should have for you to spend the time doing it. And I don't want to give the wrong impression. My impression was that overall it was a positive experience. There was much positive about it, but you would have played those cards differently if you had it to do again. Am I right?
Right, right. I will say that the benefit to me was that when you're writing about somebody else's troubles for a year and somebody else's life, you kind of get free psychotherapy along the way. and honestly, it worked that way for me. And somehow, part of it was just learning Kathleen's own lessons that she had learned and hearing her talk about them. And part of it was just literally sometimes sitting in front of my computer bawling as I was writing about her terrible, difficult bouts with rheumatoid arthritis and being told she could never act again and how she, you know, said, you know, the heck with that stuff, I'm going to do it, and she did it. But, yeah, it was, I guess what I found was that I had spent my entire life letting myself be subsumed by the needs of other people. And as wonderful as my career was with Planned Parenthood, and I would have to say that there's nothing better than knowing that what you're doing is really helping people in the way that I believe Planned Parenthood does. Still, at the end of the day, I had never really been able to use my voice on my own behalf. And then I found when I was writing the book with Kathleen that it turned out I was reliving that same pattern, that I was doing it again. And so here I was already a grandmother, and just now learning that lesson. So I just have a lot of living yet that I need to do. And so I need to live to be 120 to write all the books that I want to write in my own voice. And that's actually what propelled me to write this book, No Excuses, and what made me want to make it not just a book about why women resist power and why we are why we are, but I wanted to really put into it very specific what I call the power tools to share with women some of the things I had learned and that I learned from other women as I was going about writing the book. Because, you know, I am a practical activist, and I want to be able to not just talk about something, but actually talk about what do we do about it. And so that it was a therapeutic process all the way around. I had a little year's free psychotherapy while I was writing the book with Kathleen. I learned my lesson. I learned that I need to be a lot more intentional, and I wanted to mention the use that you have of the word intentional in your opening intro, I was fascinated by the fact that you use that word also, and I want to find out more about what you mean by that. And so now I'm trying to do it. Now I'm trying to do it. And so I guess that's not funny. That's very serious. This is real serious for me. I want to be intentional with the rest
serious.
Of my life.
Yeah, it is serious, and you're doing very important work and very good work. You know, one of the things that you are up against, and it's something that I've certainly felt in my own life, and it has to do with your understanding that people don't always hear things the way you would prefer that they do. That sometimes people are not ready to hear what you have to say. And that really was the source of my idea to put it on a cake. It goes back to, you know, the whole idea, and you mention her in your book, Frances Perkins.
Mm-hmm.
Perkins, who, and of course, as someone who teaches women's history, I'm sure that's a big part of it. But she talked about the obligation we have to other women.
To sit in the high seats. I love that. I love that phrase. I felt that I needed to go sit in the high seats so that women far distant would be able to do the same thing. I mean, yeah, that sense of continuity. And that's also part of what I'm talking about when I talk about Sister Courage. It's like I think that we don't always teach the next generation the power of a movement. We don't always teach the next generation how important it is for each of us to help bring somebody else through, you know, those doors that we've gone through. So
it's more than that, Gloria, in my opinion, because, Frances, and I'm sure you've had the same experience. I have had the good fortune to meet some women who worked in her secretariat. You know, they're
uh-huh.
quite elderly now. They really had the idea and the vision at that time that what they were doing was of service to other women because they were there, you know, willing to do it, sit in the high seats and so forth. But now young women are told, you don't have obligations, you have choices. And
that,
to me, is very, very sad. How do you combat that? How do you make obligation as sexy as choices?
Oh, that's a great question. I guess first of all, young women sometimes complain that they have too many choices. How hard it is to make choices when you have so many options. I don't tend to feel real sorry for them when they say that. But sometimes they feel like they're just weighted down by the fact that they have so many choices. And what I think that we need to do is we need to figure out a way, whether it's changing the way history is taught in schools right now, whether it's finding new ways using whatever medium or media we can decide to use to infuse girls as they're growing up with a sense of pride in the history of the accomplishments of women and of recognition that there's still a lot of progress we need to make and that whatever they do, they're making history for the next person. You know, give them a sense that what they're doing is something bigger than themselves. I think everybody needs to feel that what they're doing is bigger than themselves. And I actually think people are happier when they're not just talking about choices from the point of view of I want to make my own self happy, but when they're thinking about choices from the point of view of what's the greater good that I'm doing. I mean, maybe I'm just kind of a sappy optimist. I don't know, but that's how I feel about it.
Well, clearly you are a sappy optimist.
Well,
and I think that's okay. But let me tell you, I have a very distinct memory of a lunch I had in downtown Washington, D.C., probably at a restaurant that you've eaten at before because it was right around the corner from the D.C. Planned Parenthood. And across the street, kind of across, it was on L Street is where
it
was. Okay.
Probably
so. What I did was I was of the habit of doing this. A young woman, not someone I worked with directly, but someone who worked in our organization, was leaving her employment to go to law school. And since I am a lawyer, you know, I always took people like that to lunch because they were kind enough to sit and hear me wax on about the whole thing. And there were two things that I remember from that lunch, one that were just horrified me. One was that my wallet got stolen, and it was stolen by a professional thief, and it had my Palm Pilot, a lot of cash, credit cards, which he immediately took out and bought very expensive things with. I mean, he was good. And so I remember that. That was horrible. And then I remember the look on the face of my luncheon companion when I suggested to her that possibly it wasn't a good idea to go to law school with the idea that it would give you so much flexibility to, you know, hang out at home, work part-time as a lawyer.
That's what she thought?
I said, I really think it's going to take a generation of women lawyers who are hell-bent on making partner just to change the profession in a profound way to bring some parity to it. And she looked at me with just, you know, a shocked look on her face that I would suggest that she might have an obligation to women and to the profession to really achieve at it.
Well, I can empathize with that situation that you had. I can empathize with your feelings about that. I've heard so many conversations among women who were the first this or the first that, and then they just despair when they don't see younger women continuing to have that same kind of drive to go on up the ladder as they have had after they felt like they had opened the doors and opened up those high seats for women. And I mean, I had the same conversation, a similar conversation with my daughter, who decided to leave the workforce when she had children. And she just thought I was crazy when I would say to her, you know, you really should at least keep doing something along the way because you just never know. Well, sure enough, now 15 years later, she's in the middle of a divorce and she is in dire financial straits, and you know, her ex-husband has, of course, moved on and has another woman in his life and other priorities. And these things happen. It's not that you want to think they're going to happen. It's not that you want to make them happen. It's just that sometimes life doesn't always hand you that cake and with a nice little cherry on top. And so I just, you know, it's these are the kinds of things that young women need to hear about, and they need to hear about it not just once, but quite a few times. So they begin to understand the importance of that intentionality in their lives.
That's absolutely true. And the couple of things, I think we're both fans of Linda Hirschman's book, Get to Work.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of women do not like that book.
Right.
Okay. And Linda failed to put it on a cake. I think it's the problem.
Well, I call Linda my tough love feminist friend.
No, she actually is, and I haven't interviewed her, but I've had a conversation with her, and she is tough. Okay,
She's very tough.
But I love her message, and she's exactly right. And we need, that's kind of what I mean, we need to be very forthright in explaining these things, and we need to say it over and over again. The problem is, though, for someone like me, I am not perfect.
No.
I too, want it both ways. And, you know, let me tell you a few of my horrendous faults, and then you can comment. Okay?
Oh, I can't wait.
Well, I want it both ways. I want to find it appalling that women candidates for office are criticized about their appearance, and then I also want to criticize them for their appearance.
Oh.
I do this all the time.
Do you?
I do.
What's your pet peeve? I want to know.
Well, I even blogged about it. I have this very quirky blog, New Media Martini, and I blogged about the fact that, I really shouldn't compound my, you know, my sins by committing them over again. But I've had problems with Meg Whitman because she doesn't wear mascara. Okay.
Ah.
And, you know, that's just silly, isn't it? It's just totally silly.
Well, yeah, actually. No, I think silly is not the word that I would use. I think it is
obnoxious.
Really more, no, I think it's more just a reflection of a culture that we live in that still does judge women much more harshly on our appearance than they judge men. And while Bill Clinton had a few ups and downs for having had a haircut that was criticized, and I think maybe John Edwards the same, and Al Gore's brown suits weren't looked on too positively. But other than that, I can't think of men being really criticized for their appearance, whereas every woman who puts herself out in the public eye is subject to all kinds of criticism. And, you know, whatever it may be, whether it's
amazing.
It is amazing. And it is.
And I find it appalling.
And I think the good news is that after Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign, I don't care about the, I do care about the fact that, you know, that there was the Hillary nutcracker and that they talked about her ankles and her hair and her voice and her laugh and everything. But you know
What about the day she showed cleavage? There was that.
Absolutely. That, oh my God, that was really hysterical. But in the end, nobody questions anymore whether a strong, great leader can come in a turquoise pantsuit and with a cackle. I mean, you know, people now are much more, that women in leadership roles are much more normalized. And the more that happens, I think the less women will get criticized for some particular physical attribute or whether they wear mascara or whether they're in a turquoise pantsuit. I just think that that's going to happen.
Well, and the thing you bring up, Gloria, and it is so true, and I've lived it myself so much, is the importance of visibility, the importance of actually seeing a woman in a certain role. And there's so much power in that. And I will tell you, I mean, this is just kind of a strange, odd story, once again, about me, but the reason I started thinking about going to law school is I saw Sarah Weddington at Close Range. Now, I'm happy to say she and I are friends now. This was many years ago when we were both, as we still are, young women. and, you know, I went to an event that it was on a Saturday. It was an event for women, and it was not well attended. I didn't really talk to her personally. I was just kind of not even interested about the fact that she had argued and won Roe v. Wade. What I was interested in was I was saying, oh, my God, we're kind of alike. There's a Texas girl, and she went to law school. That's kind of amazing. Huh, I could probably do that. I wonder if I could do that.
Exactly. You can see it. You can't be it if you can't see it, as
if
they
you
say.
Can't see it. But I could see, you know, suddenly I could see it, and it was just a turning point for me. Now, since I have criticized Meg Whitman's non-use of mascara, one of the things that she did that was so amazing, I'm sure you're familiar with this, but her huge gift to Princeton University some years back. It was, at that time, maybe the largest financial gift that any woman had made.
Right.
That we're aware of. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that interested me, and since that's my field, women in philanthropy, one of the things that interested me was how she wanted it spent. Do you know what that money went for?
I don't. I'd love to know. Tell me.
She had them build a dormitory. And I thought, that's weird. Hmm. You know, why would she be interested in giving $100 million? I think that's about what it was, $100 million for a dormitory at Princeton. I just didn't get it. Well, a few years later, I had never been on the Princeton campus, but a few years later, I was speaking at a women in philanthropy conference in Princeton, but it wasn't sponsored by Princeton. It was sponsored by Rutgers University. And I had the opportunity to go to the Princeton campus. It's hard to get on. I kind of drove around it. But then suddenly I got it. Every single dormitory had the name of a prominent male philanthropist. So there was Rockefeller, you know, on and on like that. And it's engraved at the very top of the dormitory. so think what a wonderful thing it would be for women at Princeton to walk on that campus and see a towering dormitory that said Whitman. Think of it.
Meg Whitman, specifically. Yes.
Yes.
Perfect, perfect.
It
well,
is
that's,
perfect.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I, in No Excuses, you may recall that I wrote a big piece about the Women Moving Millions campaign. And some more Texas women, by the way, Swanee and Helen Hunt, who have put in many millions of their own dollars and are challenging women all over the country who can write checks at the $1 million level or more over a period of a couple or 3 years to do that and to really ratchet up their notions of their capacity and their responsibility and the value of women giving at that kind of level. Because let's face it, what is power in our society but money? It always comes down to money, and philanthropy is a great way for women to exercise that power too that I talk about.
No, it absolutely is, and it's necessary. And the culture of women and giving is so, in many ways, wrapped around powerlessness. It's about it's about collaboration, but it's one of those things. We've been told that every little bit counts, and we haven't been told that it only counts a little bit.
Oh.
The thing we fail to hear. So anyway, and what is the thing that has surprised you the most as you've gone out and talked about your book? And you have been, you know, it's just been amazing. You've had a very impressive book promotion campaign, both in mainstream media and in social media. So you're very modern in that respect. It's great. What's been a surprise?
Well, I think the biggest positive surprise has been the numbers of women bloggers, particularly women who are entrepreneurs, women who are in their, say, 30s and 40s, who are just soaking it up and eating it up. And I don't know why that surprised me. I had anticipated that there would be many young women, because there are a lot of young women who are looking for mentorship, and they told me that, and they, you know, they want to know our stories, they want to know how we dealt with challenges. They're looking for guidance in a lot of ways. So I expected to have a lot of young women who were excited about the book. And I expected that a lot of women my age would be interested in it, because after all, we've lived the second wave. We're just generally interested in women advancing in this way. And the biggest surprise to me has been how many women in that middle group, and in particular women in the business world and particularly in the entrepreneurial world, who are blogging about it, loving it, soaking it up, like putting the – I made a postcard that has the nine ways on it, and I get these notes from them that say they've got it up on their bulletin board. They put it up over their computer. They actually quote from it. And I've started a blog called Nine Ways. So it's on my website, which is just easy to remember, GloriaFelt.com. If you can remember that my name is spelled F-E-L-D-T, that is. And so it's just called the Nine Ways blog. And I'm talking about one of these power tools every week right now, and encouraging women to share their stories. I wish more women would share their stories on the website. What happens often is I put up a post and I say, please come tell your story here, and then they send me personal emails because they aren't quite ready to put their story up in public. And I'm encouraging them to share it with other women because other women want to know. That's how we learn. That's how we communicate with each other is through stories so often. So anyway, those are the surprises, and I'm trying to figure out more ways, and would love anybody to offer me suggestions. I'm trying to figure out more ways to offer women the ability to actually have that conversation with each other, with me on my website or wherever, because I think it is in the conversation that we continue to reach an ever-growing number of women.
Oh, I agree. That all sounds wonderful. We will have to talk. We'll for sure have to talk about that. Well, but first, let's talk about those power tools. I mean, I was very intrigued by the fact that you used what I would consider a male analogy, power tools, for these nine tools that you give. You know, I just wonder, did you do research about whether women could relate to power tools? Do women even own power tools? I will tell you, I do. I'm a woman who does. I own an electric hand sander, a smoothie maker, and a rechargeable drill that was actually a gift from a male admirer.
So oh, I'm I can impressed. Kind of
power tools. How did you come up with that concept?
It was just generic in writing the book because I was writing about power and somehow power tools just organically came to my mind. And no, I didn't do any research to find out if anybody was going to like it. But I have to tell you a very cute story that I heard from Joe Connison, who interviewed me for the Progressive Book Club a couple of days ago. And he said that he had a 3-year-old daughter who was asking him about some tool that he had, some power tool that he had, and he asked her if she wanted one, and she said, no, boys use tools, men use tools, girls don't use tools. And he said, well, you certainly can, and in fact, you can even ask Santa Claus for some tools for Christmas. And she was very skeptical about this, and then a couple of weeks later, she came back to him and said, I'm going to ask Santa Claus for some tools for Christmas. And I thought, well, now that's really great. That's great to have a father coaching his girl along, his daughter along, to make sure that she knew that, yes, indeed, power tools are not gendered. Anybody can have them. Anybody can use them. And I just thought that was a very sweet story.
Yeah, that's adorable. So power tools, nine of them.
Nine of them. Which one do you want to talk about?
Well, I was going to offer you that option.
Oh, great. Well, we talked about one already. We talked about defining your own terms.
Mm-hmm.
That's the second power tool, but if I had to say which one I thought was the most important, I would probably say that one. But let me talk about one that I particularly love. The one that says embrace controversy. I love that power tool. And I love it because it's not one that we instinctively embrace. And particularly as women, we tend to back off from conflict. And controversy, of course, inherently often involves some conflict, some confrontation, and it makes us uncomfortable. But what I learned, and again, I didn't know this when I started out in life, and in fact, I was pretty timid when I started out in life, wouldn't express my opinion, didn't want to take a public stance, but as I worked in first the civil rights movement and other social justice movements, and then in the women's movement and reproductive rights, what I came to understand is that if you embrace controversy, it causes people to think about the issue. And in fact, if something you do causes a controversy, it means that people are paying attention to you. And when they're paying attention to you, you've got a platform. And when you've got a platform, you can present your case. And when you can present your case, you make people think about the subject that you feel passionate about. And then when they think about it, they have to clarify how they believe about it. And that is really ultimately how you make change. And so I encourage women to embrace controversy and use the energy of it. Use the energy of it. I have, just like you have your cake metaphor, I read an article in the New York Times after the big tsunami in Indonesia. And they led the story off with an interview that they did with a man who had been by himself in a tiny little boat on the high seas. And saw the big waves coming at him, and instead of ducking them, he knew that he needed to ride into the wave, that he needed to turn the boat directly into the wave, and that the energy of that wave would actually propel him to where he needed to go. And so that's not quite as easy to show people as a cake, but a metaphor that really has stuck in my mind. Use
yeah.
that energy. It creates
energy. That
is energy.
A great one.
Yeah.
And, the reason that metaphor is so powerful is that the fact that he's alive speaks for itself, right?
Oh, doesn't it, though? Yes, exactly.
It really does.
Yeah.
You know, I want to go back to your idea about redefining, because the truth of the matter is, and people who know me are shocked at this claim, I'm a very deep thinker. You know, I'm rather brilliant, and I when I
and
put
humble,
my mind
and humble.
but I've been thinking a lot about the concept of redefining something as opposed to defining it, and wondering about that. Just wondering about it.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a difference? Is there truly a difference? And if there is, does it matter?
I guess there is kind of a difference, because if you're defining something, you may be the first person to lay claim to it. And if we were to make up a new word that we would be able to define totally on our own, that would be an interesting thing.
Right.
But the concept of power is out there, and it's the kind of thing, you know, you can use a hammer to break something to pieces, or you can use a hammer to build something, but either way, you're using power.
Right. Well, see, one of the things that's been a pet peeve of mine for a long time, and you address this somewhat in your book, is when powerful, successful women are interviewed about how it all came to be, so many times they don't claim their own power. They want to call it something that happened, a matter of luck, just
yes,
drifting down life's path.
Mm-hmm.
They refuse to even take enough of an interior look to determine whether or not they were, in fact, somewhat strategic, even if they are unwilling to acknowledge it. And that just drives me crazy, Gloria.
Well, I've totally done that. So when I tell the story of how I got to be doing the jobs that I did with Planned Parenthood, including the national job, I always tell it like, oh, you know, I was just there. It just happened. They just asked me to do it, and that was that. And I'm trying to recreate my ability to say, yeah, you know what? I guess I had some skills that were absolutely the right things that allowed me to do that job. And here are the things I did that I'm really proud of. It's hard to do. It's hard to do. You know, we have been taught to be nice, haven't we? We've been taught to be nice. We've been taught to think of other people's feelings. We've been taught to put other people first. And
to not call attention to ourselves. And to
keep your head down.
Self-aggrandizing and all of that. But
right,
the fact is, I think you probably were strategic, and it was very instrumental in your success, because one of the things that I can identify that you did, you were a woman who took it on, and you were going someplace with it. You were going to accomplish something. And so one of the things that you did is you worked hard enough that you became very successful in your job, and people took notice, because
right,
it wasn't expected. You accomplished way more than they expected. You accomplished at least 10 times what they expected.
Well, that's true, but also you know, when I think about what I did, and when you think about when a woman has that kind of, or has an ambition to accomplish some things, or has the money to accomplish some things, she'll perhaps start a movement. She sees something that, you know, a man will run for office. A man will start a business. And so I was actually playing in what is a pretty traditional female narrative, in that I became active in social movements. And then I actually ended up making that my career. So I often think to myself, now, what if I had begun at the, what if I were beginning over? You know, what if I were starting over? What would I actually do? As I said before, I say this, you know, in the Jerry Seinfeld sense, not that there's anything wrong with that. I'm delighted that I was able to work in a field where I was able to provide so much help to so many people. But what would I have done? I have no idea. And I just hope that young women can learn from us to be intentional in that way, and to really think earlier on in life. It's more than making a choice. It's really thinking deeply, being intentional, thinking about what is it that you're really qualified for? What is it that your gifts would tell you to do? and maybe it would be working in the nonprofit world, but maybe it would be becoming President of the United States.
Oh, Gloria, I have to tell this story. Ann Richards, who I am just assuming you knew, and perhaps
yes.
you will.
Mm-hmm.
When I first was an employee of my not-for-profit organization, one of the first things I did was attend our national convention, and it was at Disneyland on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And Ann Richards was the keynote speaker for one day, and she gave a fabulous speech. And starting with the joke that the first thing she had done upon arriving was she had taken everything possible from her room that had Disney on it and packed it away in her suitcase to take to the grandchildren. But her speech covered a lot of ground, and I think every woman who heard it left with a different message and the message that was important for her. For me, it was Anne's statement that she had four children, two boys and two girls. The two sons were very successful financially. The two girls had gone to nicey-nice careers. And we're just
nicey-nice. I love that. That sounds so Anne.
Doesn't it? They've gone to nicey-nice careers, and they were struggling. And I stood there and wept because I had dissolved a very somewhat successful law practice and moved to the East Coast to take this job, this nicey-nice job. And it just, you know, I just was struck by that, the truth of it, the sad truth of it. And it's a complicated world we live in, is it not?
It is. It is very much so. And, it is definitely. I think, you know, but what we need is a sense of balance. We need a sense of balance about that. I don't think we want women to become men. I think we don't want men to become women. I think we want to figure out how to have a culture that's more balanced, where we use the good parts of both of those approaches, because there's nothing wrong with making money, and there's nothing wrong with doing nicey-nice things. In fact, they're both essential. You can do a lot more nicey-nice things when you have some money to do it with. So how do we balance that out and get the best of the masculine and feminine? Maybe the big challenge of the next generation.
Well, it is a big challenge, and that next generation is so fortunate to have you to look to show them the way. You've just been a delightful guest, and I say again to listeners, to y'all who are listening, Gloria, to all y'all who are listening, buy a dozen copies of Gloria's book. You are going to really enjoy reading it. She's talked about a very powerful and important subject in a very engaging way. It's No Excuses, 9 Ways Women Can Change How We Think About Power. Thank you so much for being here today, Gloria.
Thank you, Kay. It has been a lot of fun and very serious fun.
You have been listening to Women Are Not Funny Radio, a New Media International production. On behalf of Kay Ballard, her fabulous guest, and the secretly hilarious Women Are Not Funny team, thanks for being here. You can listen to our replays anytime you please, but it's so much more fun when you're here. So join us again live next Friday afternoon for Women Are Not Funny Radio.